Please be seated. Continue on. And the next speaker is John Ebbett. Mr. Ebbett? Same rules about there's no repeating, because we want to have an administrative conference, too, after our next petition. Thank you for coming twice.
May it please the Court, my comments are very brief. I am John Ebbett. I'm Executive Director of Legal Action of Wisconsin. Legal Action strongly supports the rule amendment requested in Rule Petition Number 10-03. In our written comments, we set forth our concern that compensation rates are so low that few attorneys can afford to accept appointments. Today, I would like to provide an example of this. Mr. Friedbert spoke of his law firm cost doing business, and Mr. Dell also talked about the number of solo practitioners. I'd like to provide an example of this in the person of Legal Action's board president, attorney Roger Klopp. Roger has given me permission to relate his situation to the court. He's unable to appear before you personally because he has court appearances today. Roger has been practicing law for 21 years. His office is in Columbia County, and he practices there and in surrounding counties. Almost all of Roger's practice consists of public defender work. About 90% of his cases are appointments from the state public defender, and about 10% are court appointments. In 2009, Roger was paid $47,000 by the state public defender at $40 per hour, and $16,000 from court appointments at $70 per hour. These very low compensation rates are exacerbated by the fact that in-county travel time is not compensated. Thus, if he drives 30 minutes from Lodi to Portage for a 20-minute pretrial and then drives 30 minutes back to Lodi, he is compensated for only 20 minutes, $13.20 for 80 minutes of actual time spent. This is $9.90 per hour for actual time spent. Last year, Roger's adjusted gross income was $27,655. This puts him very near the federal poverty level of $22,050 for a family of four. He is, in fact, nearly eligible for representation by Legal Action of Wisconsin, as our income eligibility level is $27,563, just $92 less than Roger's adjusted gross income. Roger is a single parent with three children. Two of his children are presently on Badger Care. At this point, Roger is seriously looking at getting out of public defender work and into other areas such as family law, minor estate planning, and privately paying criminal defense cases. He terms his present practice subsistence lawyering and believes that he cannot continue this much longer. What happens to the fundamental right to the aid of counsel when counsel like Roger Klopp are driven out of public defender representation because compensation rates are absurdly low? That right disappears. Thank you.
But, Mr. Abbott, most of the people who all the people who spoke him were asked the question, if he's appointed by the state public defender, this proposal won't increase his income. It'll only increase his income on the 10% that he gets a court appointment. We agree on that?
Well, we agree on that.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you.
Carlo Escueda, clerk of the Circuit Court, Dane County. Good seeing you, sir.
Good afternoon, Justices. It's an honor to appear before you today, and may it please the Court. My name is Carlo Escueda, Clerk of Circuit Court for Dane County. I'm actually here to represent the Wisconsin Clerks of Circuit Court Association. Our association president, Karen Hepfler of Chippewa County, tendered a letter to you dated September 28th that outlined the association's position with regard to this petition. Given that individual counties face very different financial situations and take differing approaches to contracting and to collections of reimbursements, the association didn't take a specific position for or against the $80 figure that's in the petition. Rather, we consider this a review process, not unlike that's contemplated in the rule. And we certainly trust that when you make your decision of how this rule should be modified, that you'll make that decision with all due diligence and discretion and consideration of all the political and financial and other factors that come into it. We do, however, object to the notion that future changes to this amount should be linked to the Consumer Price Index. We just don't think it's a good idea for the court to relinquish discretion in this regard and just make it, you know, automatic and sort of slave to that outside indicator. We just think that the court could recommit to the notion of periodic reviews as the rule currently provides for and, again, take this up at its discretion and set it accordingly. We really didn't have a position on the sub 3 that really is the controversial issue, as it involves a relationship between the state and the bar that the counties really aren't going to be a part of. The only way that occurred to me over lunch, the only way that might be an issue, is if the rule were crafted such that circuit court judges took it to mean that if there was a public defender appointment at the $40 rate, that the judges would feel some obligation under the rule to assess the difference between the $40 and $80 to the county, in which case that would be a different conversation.
Which the proponents say that's not the rule.
Exactly.
You think it can be read otherwise?
I went back. I thought Justice Ziegler had a good point with the sort of advisory nature of the rules that pertain to courthouse construction and so forth. There certainly is a place in the rule for shoulds and advisory type messages to other legislative and executive bodies, and this could be that if framed properly.
Does it read that way to you now?
Right now, no. Right now, it raises a lot of questions and ambiguity in my mind when I read it as to whether it contains any effective force.
Thank you. Thank you, counsel. Brian Gleason, attorney, Madison, Wisconsin. Mr. Gleason, welcome.
Thank you.
Same
Thank
rules
you,
apply.
Chief Justice. In 1979, I opened up the public defender's office when the office went statewide with the trial division offices. The year before that, they had a pilot office in Fond du Lac. I was in that office as a third-year law student. I remained a public defender for 3 years. I've been in private practice since that time. I have then taken public defender cases for 28 years. I can tell you the rate at $25 an hour in 1979 was a rate that my colleagues in the private bar were telling me then did not meet overhead in 1979. It doesn't meet overhead today. It's risen by $15 in 31 years, a little less than 50 cents an hour per year. It's inadequate. People like me who take public defender cases, I'm in my second homicide, my third or fourth armed robbery and sexual assaults. I go around the state of Wisconsin in the southwestern part of the state because I go where nobody else will go. I take the cases that nobody else will take in Grant County and Vernon County and Richland County, because counsel will not go there, are not qualified to go there, and will not accept homicide cases, sexual assault, and armed robbery cases at that rate. I think I'm part of the problem because I'm willing to do it. And, you know, like Roger Klopp, you know, I take a beating because of it. I probably average about $35,000 a year net income. It's been less in the last couple of years because the public defender appointments in the private bar have decreased fairly dramatically because of some changes in the laws. Last year, I think I had $28,000 worth of net income. This year, that's almost half of that, and I found out I qualified for Badger Care, which is nice because it's the first time I've had health care in 5 years. We've taken the fiscal responsibility that the state legislature should have on our backs for too long, for way too long. And it's we shouldn't have to defend the people and take it out of our back pockets away from the tuition that I need to put away for my children. We just can't do it any longer. And if the legislature refuses to increase the rate of pay, which it did 2 years ago when I testified before Representative Kessler's committee, if it did so 4 years before that when we had surplus in the budget, we cannot expect the legislature to change anything.
Mr. Gleason, what part, as best you can estimate, of your appointments come from the state public defender so that they're covered by $40, and what part come from court appointments?
I haven't had any court appointments. When I was riding on the elevator 35 minutes ago, there was an advertisement from the Dane County to lawyers to take rates at $40 an hour, excuse me, at $400 for misdemeanor, $700 for a felony. They're trying to get us in the private bar to take that as part of their indigent representation under State versus Dean. I don't think you can do a felony for $700.
That would have come under 1M, that is, you'd make a contract, I assume.
That's right. Okay. That's the public.
Mr. Gleason, as I understand this from each of the proponents, if this were passed, it wouldn't help you at all because the state public defender rate is not changed at all under this proposal.
I think that if whatever efforts the public defender have undertaken so far and will undertake, and I know they're very diligent about this, they're good people.
They've tried.
I know they have. I've met with these the administrative staff, and they've tried very hard. Unfortunately, the legislature has consistently said we're not going to put dollars into defense lawyers. We're going to put them in our prison systems. Mm-hmm. You know, I keep people out of prison. Every time I keep a person out of prison, I save the state $35,000. The legislature doesn't recognize that. And I think that as Frank Johnson, the district court judge in Alabama, once said to the Alabama legislature, unless you start paying the lawyers, we're going to start selling off the state forest. He made that threat about 25 years ago. I don't know that he made good on it, but at least from his perspective, the Constitution mandated that the right to counsel means you got to pay the lawyer. The public defender sent me an email, says, I'm not going to get paid after February of this year until the budget passes in July. You know, we who do this day in and day out wonder how we're going to pay our bills. To the extent that you can say to the legislature, we think that $80 is at least the amount of money that lawyers could get, maybe the legislature will have some sort of benchmark. Because when I testified before the legislature, some of the people were saying, well, boy, it sounds like $40 an hour. It sounds pretty good to me. And they get out their calculators and they multiply that by 2,000 hours. I think that this body has a responsibility to say to the legislature, we need more. And I don't know if it has to be done by legislative fiat or by petition, but I think there has to be a joining of hands because I think everybody's got the responsibility to pay for the lawyer. I've got the responsibility to serve the public because that's what I choose to do. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Gleason. John Barrett, Clerk of Circuit Court, Milwaukee County.
Chief Justice, fellow justices, my name is John Barrett. I'm the Clerk of Court for Milwaukee County. I want to speak to you with regard to this because we in the counties are working on periods of fixed budgets. And when we have the fixed budgets that we have, any potential increase within that budget means that whatever I have to do with less. So if there's an upward pressure on the the legal fees that we have, and as has been earlier stated, that Milwaukee County is roughly $5 million in legal fees. That means if my budget is fixed at $42 million and the $5 million goes up to, let's say it's 10% if it's a direct correlation to the increase from 70 to 80, that would mean that my budget would go up to $550,000. And that means that somewhere else I have to find $500,000 to operate in the court system in Milwaukee. That makes it very problematic for me. And while I am an attorney and I understand and I know that this is a difficulty that attorneys face, that this pay, particularly in the public defender, I view this as kind of a backdoor way of sending the message to the state legislature while at the same time sending me the bill. And I am very, very troubled by that because we end up picking up that increased cost. I know that you have early, and you wanted me to address particularly previous questions. I think that Justice Prosser earlier hit it on the head when he said that we're in this tight financial times and that we're looking at things going down. I think that's going to happen on the county level as well, particularly when it comes to shared revenues. If shared revenues are cut and other aspects are cut, we're going to face even tougher budgets than we are now. And while I very much laud the idea of paying attorneys what they're supposed to get, it becomes very problematic for us in our offices to operate. I did go down at lunchtime and talk to John Velker, and they in fact have a listing by county, which I think Judge Rogensack asked whether there was a listing by county.
The audits that are filed. That's when the county audits filed.
But it's still considered unaudited. But
right.
It is
some
confined.
Counties have been audited. Has Milwaukee County been
I don't
audited?
Believe that we've okay. been audited as yet. But in the numbers, they provided me 2008 and 2009. Our total expenses were $5 million. Our recoupment was $105,000. Now, I know that Justice Ziegler asked previously regarding the recoupment of funds. Recoupment in Washington County and recoupment in Milwaukee County are far different things. One of the things that we have to address is judges' reluctance to order reimbursement from people they find indigent. If they find someone absolutely indigent, they don't necessarily feel it's appropriate for them to add to their indigency problem by ordering a recoupment.
Is the $5 million just indigent criminal defendant appointments that the county pays for?
No. Those cases are Dean cases, which is State v. Dean. And in those State v. Dean cases, our expenditures for the numbers are vastly different between 2008 and 2009. I think we discovered that we were reporting them incorrectly in 2008. In 2009, our Dean expenditures were roughly $400,000. $394,370 was the number out of the $5 million. We also, one of the other things that you asked earlier, dealt with the types of cases. We have cases in which individuals are represented in CHIPS cases, individuals are represented in TPR, in GLs and Watts cases. We have all different types of cases, and the level of reimbursement of those cases in Milwaukee County varies as well. So we have a lower amount of reimbursement for some perfunctory type of cases, and that makes it difficult if you say, and I know that Justice Abramson raised the issue of the unreasonableness, and is a problem to me. I think that might be, could be, or not at all would be fine with me to suggest that it's unreasonable is something that I think judges will look at it and make an order. If it says it's unreasonable, they're going to make the $80 order, and that for us is problematic.
Mr. Barron, when you say you expended $5 million and got $105,000 back, what did you get from the state?
We also get roughly $1 million in our GAL reimbursement. That has been constant since the early 90s. It hasn't changed at all other than going down nominally.
What about the court services support program?
I think we get about, again, this is going off my memory.
I know.
I think we get about a total of roughly $5 million for reimbursement, and that includes the $1 million. I think it's like broken down 1/7 each half year. Okay. I would have to double check that.
Yeah, if you get all that money back, then what's your net expenditure?
I think our next net expenditures for lawyers is roughly around $3.9 million.
You think that's net?
$3.9 million. And okay. And when she talked about it, the numbers here, the
she
gross.
She is Ms. Diedrich?
Yes, I'm sorry.
Go ahead.
Ms. Sarah Diedrich.
Yeah, a lot of she's here.
Yes. yes, indeed.
The record reflect that one too.
The total expense listed in 2009 is $19,195,000. And change that the recoupment was roughly $7,000,001, with the 4/7 of GAL reimbursement. See, I differentiate the court support services from the GAL.
I understand, which is one of the points of having this auditor and having uniform reporting, so we get to know exactly what the counties have put in.
Right.
So I understand your difficulty of answering the question. So there's a net figure. You figure it out at about $4 million, give or take.
Yes, and that represents roughly 50% of the state total, which is so to me, this is an important issue because it impacts us directly in my budget particularly. And so while I again laud the idea of paying lawyers more, I think it's a good idea. It really impacts my budget directly, and I am I understand that it is probably necessary to increase the pay of public defenders, but I'm not sure doing it through raising this particular amount, which roughly represents about half again the amount that we expend, which would mean that amount would go up. And I would prefer that not happen. It's just my two cents worth. And that you essentially look at the world in which we live. And the world in which we live now is one where money is extraordinarily tight. And that's just what I understand that need, but we live in very tough times with regard to counties and reimbursement and everything else. So,
are the dean appointments at $70 an hour in Milwaukee?
I think that depends upon the judge, and it depends again upon the complexity of the case, and some judges have opinions as to that this case deserves X amount. Some judges say it deserves more or less than that. And so...
So you don't have a fixed rate in Milwaukee appointments...
The chief judge of Milwaukee has tried very hard to make that there be more consistency among the rate at which judges issue orders for this. But as... The
part of
chief.
There being a difference in GAL appointments versus dean appointments.
Yeah, I don't think that's necessarily the difference that that the chief judge in Milwaukee is necessarily referring to. But if you have a dean appointment, that you have wildly fluctuating appointments within a dean, but I think they say, well, okay, GALs should be approximately this amount depending upon this type of case. Deans should be this amount depending upon the complexity of the case.
So
and, of course,
judges,
there are always exceptions.
Some judges might be 70 an hour and some might be 40 an hour?
Yes.
Really?
I believe that's the case in Milwaukee.
I didn't know that.
Tell us what dean appointments are, just so we're all on the same page.
The dean appointments, as I understand it, are where the Supreme Court has said, or the court has said in the Dean cases, that while the public defender's determination of indigency is indicative of what their budget is, the court has a different understanding of what indigency is, and so therefore they can appoint.
That's right, because the state public defender standards date back to 1987 or something.
Right.
So that they're not accurate reflections of today, and therefore as a constitutional matter, the court has to appoint counsel in criminal cases where there's a penalty of incarceration potential.
Yeah, and those cases are then appointed
by the court.
By the court. Now,
have any contracts in Milwaukee?
We have contracts mainly at Children's Court, relating to cases out at Children's Court. I will say this much: the legislature addressed somewhat the issue of the Dean cases when they addressed the indigency standard,
which don't come into effect for a while, and they haven't been funded either.
Right.
I understand it.
Right. It's my understanding that they would come into effect at the mid-year point here, and that it would impact us in the second half of the year. I don't know that with the change in the legislature, that's coming up, the year that's coming up, we'd get the second half of the year, we would then get funding because it would correspond to the state's fiscal year. But you know, given the circumstances of the change in the legislature and, in my opinion, the unfortunate outcome of the gubernatorial election, I basically think that it's going to be a vastly different legislature when it comes to this type of the matter with respect to even the public defenders.
Justice Prosser.
I understood your testimony, Mr. Barrett, that the source of money to pay for dean appointments and guardian ad litem appointments and that sort of thing is your budget. Is that correct?
That would be the case. I mean, for dean appointments, the public defender makes a determination that the individual doesn't qualify for their services. The court makes a determination that they are indigent and therefore are entitled to representation, and they order the county to make payment in those cases. They also order the county to make payment in GAL cases.
The county board is making a budget now, and they have to make a budget for your office. Are they building those payments into your budget, or is there some other budget?
No, it's within my budget, and it represents, I think, roughly 12% of my budget is the attorney costs, and that's why I get concerned when those amounts go up, because our budget remains flat generally, that we stay at $42 million, and when they increase those costs, then I end up with a lesser budget to operate on, and so that's where I have difficulties with respect to this.
Now, in the statistics that were reported by counties in October, I understand that there's a heading, there's a number under the heading Attorney's Other Expenses, $1.731 million. Isn't that the dean expenditures?
No, there's a column next to the dean expenditures, or next to the 1.7. The other expenditures in Milwaukee County, the other attorney expenditures can be adversary counsel. So you may have in CHIPS cases, you have parents who judges determine are entitled to representation. So that's not necessarily a GAL appointment. It's more of an what I call an adversary counsel appointment, where a parent might have an interest in a particular outcome of a case, but they're not. It's not necessarily for incompetency or age or other things that GAL appointments come in under.
I certainly don't want to get into any disagreement with the distinguished county clerk of courts of Milwaukee, but when I got figures from the Legislative Fiscal Bureau, they said guardian ad litem expenses are $2.8 million.
This is for Milwaukee we're talking about.
For Milwaukee.
Okay.
It is listed as $394,000 for dean expenses and $1.731 million for other attorney expenses. But then they sent me a memo that says it should be noted that Milwaukee County has indicated that amounts reported as attorney other expenses should have been reported as dean expenditures, increasing dean expenditures in Milwaukee County for the calendar year 2009 by an additional.
I think it's actually the reverse. I think if you look in 2008, the expenditures listed in 2008 showed GL expenditures of $3,051,000, dean expenditures of $1,009,000. Okay, that's what it was reported in 2008. Then when we discovered our error, we went back and we changed it so that the GL expenditures were $2,800,000. The dean expenditures were $394,000, and the other expenditures were $1,700,000. Our accountant, in going through the auditing process and coming up with the chart of accounts and other things, our accountant said, well, okay, we have our GAL, and then you have everything else. And so what she did was she put the GAL in one column and everything else in the other column. That was in 2008 when we were going through the whole thing. Then at some point, someone from the Director of State Court's office, probably the auditor, looked at it and said, this doesn't seem quite right. And so they went through and changed it, and that's what the 2009 numbers are more adequately reflected in the $394,000 for dean cases and not the larger amount.
Are the GAL appointments all $70 an hour in Milwaukee?
They vary. I mean, like, if you have a GAL in a Watts case, we pay a flat amount of $100 per case. And that's what the attorneys agree to.
I'm just trying to figure this out. I get the bottom line. You know, if you increase fees, it increases your expenses. But if the judges aren't really paying the amount in the rule anyway, I'm trying to figure out what difference does it make.
I actually understand your question. I think that anything that...
Say $100 if the judges decide it's not.
There's a second paragraph in the current thing that says we can negotiate for whatever we
want.
Right,
and that's still there, even under the proposed rule.
Yes, and that hasn't
rule changed.
Yeah. But the judges, some judges will follow what it says. So some judges will say, it says 80, I'm paying 80. Some will say, well, you really shouldn't. Others will look at it more critically. And I'm not saying one is right or one is wrong, but I think that any time you have an upward pressure on any of this, and this pushes that up. And so when you have the $80, it pushes it up, and that, again, goes back to my original record of saying over and over again that this impacts our budget adversely.
I get what you're saying. I'm just trying to. That's very unusual. I mean, usually you'd have a list of lawyers that are taking appointments. They know this is the rate. You'd have kind of everybody has the same list to work off of, and they know. Here's what you get when you take an appointment in Milwaukee County, but. I guess not. If you're in front of one judge, you get $40 an hour. The next judge, same lawyer, you get $70 or $80?
There's some truth to that. And I will tell you that former Chief Judge Sheedy said that managing the 47 judges was like herding cats.
Yeah.
So it's not as necessarily a...
When I'm gathering from your statements are... The Milwaukee County spends a lot of money on lawyer fees, regardless of whether it's dean, indigent criminal defendants, or it's guardian ad litem, or it's adversary counsel, or anything else that counsel is appointed for. That you expend a substantial amount, you recoup from the people who get counsel very little, substantially less. You get funds from the state. They are designated in a variety of ways, but they get back to the from the state. And you may have a net expenditure of approximately $4 million, depending on how everything is figured, right?
Yes.
Give or take. And that you expect a fixed budget from the county board and don't expect it to go up. To the extent we increase from 70 to 80, there will be pressure on any counsel that will be pressure to pay that 80 on counsel appointed by the court. And then in some judges in Milwaukee County, any upward trend will put pressure on other approval of attorney fees, even if they don't directly fall within the $80. Is that a fair summary?
Yeah, I think it'll even impact our contractual cases that they'll say, well, these guys are getting more, we should get more.
Right, okay, so it even affects 1M. And you just don't have enough flexibility in your budget to handle it. Makes about a court attorney fees cost approximately 12% of your budget.
That was on my rough calculations.
Right.
I was dividing
it
while
it
we were
it.
Back over Listen, here.
We've had experience, as you know, with these audits of the counties, and as in any audit, mistakes can be found, and the whole point of this is, of the audit, is to help the counties, and they've been very appreciative when errors, or if not errors, of putting it in the wrong boxes are found, and to the extent they're done accurately, it helps you all do your budgeting.
Yes, absolutely.
All right.
And we appreciate the auditor and that direction.
And you read paragraph sub 3 as not merely we wish you would do something, legislature.
That paragraph makes me nervous.
I don't know what it means.
What?
You don't know what it means.
Yes, and I don't know how it will be interpreted by the judges. And so if the judges decide to interpret it one way, it means they have to do this. And then, as Carlos said, you know, potentially we could face the additional gap between the 40 and the others. You know, it would be a new type of dean case, which would be holy mackerel. You know, and that's just something that I don't want.
Expression. Yeah. Holy Mac.
Yes.
HC, holy cow, right?
Yes, exactly.
Depends on where you are. When you're on Lake Michigan, it's holy mackerel.
Yes, indeed.
Okay.
So I don't know if you need to hear any more from me, but I appreciate the opportunity.
Justice Prosser has a question.
Could I ask, John, on the sheet that I have, it talks about whatever the dean expense is. It says dean recoupment of $47,955.
Okay, let me get to the sheet if we're on the same page. Yes.
Now, I look, for example, at Brown County. They've got a dean recoupment of $235,000. And there are many counties that have dean recoupments larger than $47,000. I do not in any way intend to imply that anything's going wrong in Milwaukee, but is the system working differently in different counties or what?
Yeah, absolutely. And I will say I know in Washington County, and I don't mean to they appoint regardless of indigency.
That's right.
And because they appoint regardless of indigency, their collection rates are far better than ours. And so to me, on one level, that impacted other reimbursements that they got on the court support service fee. So I've long been screaming that that's not fair, just because it adversely impacts us. Secondly, you have judges, again, and I've been working with Judge Sankovitz, and Judge Sankovitz has been preparing a different type of order so that judges can order more reimbursement, and that's something I don't feel, unless I have an order for reimbursement from a court, that I can collect on it, that I need an order from the court in order to do something. And I cannot, on my own, just go out. If a judge has made a determination of indigency, I don't believe that I can go out and make collection efforts, send it to a collection agency, or do other things like that without an order from the court directing me to do that. And so I have asked the judges to, and they've worked with me on this, to try and get a greater degree of orders for reimbursement. That being said, many of the people that visit the courts in Milwaukee County are in abject poverty, and it is like squeezing blood out of a turnip. It's not going to happen.
You're working with Judge Sankovitz. He's head of the, is it the felony division or all the criminal courts?
Right off the bat, I can't tell you. Judge Sankovitz, has worked across. He was really responsible for our. He's like our Scrivener judge. He wrote a lot of the rules and other things, and so he's very good at coming up with ideas and suggestions for making things happen. And so I'm grateful to him for his assistance.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you. Any other comments or questions? Okay. Thank you very much, Mr. Barrett. We again appreciate your coming twice as all of the other speakers have. John Bertzel, Wisconsin Association of Criminal Defense Lawyers.
Court. My name is John Bertzel. I'm the chair of the Special Committee on Indigent Defense Funding for the Wisconsin Association of Criminal Defense Lawyers. I have been a private practitioner for 20 years, most all of that doing strictly criminal defense. I have a statewide practice. I've literally from one corner of the state to the other and across. And I just, you know, I submitted written testimony, but I just want to really key in on two areas. One is quality of representation, and two is the politics of all of this. Throughout this whole debate this morning and this afternoon, I've heard about budgets and counties and attorneys, but I haven't heard anybody talk about the clients. And while it's anecdotal, and I don't have a study to point to show you this, this rate is directly tied to the quality of representation these people are getting. By these people, I mean criminal defendants, indigent criminal defendants. And any of the members of this court that have served on the trial bench know exactly what I'm talking about. I'll give you a great, great example of this. About 5 years ago, I had an excited call from a young man in Eau Claire. He just walked out of a courtroom thinking he got a deal. He had a court-appointed attorney, SPD appointment, who absolutely should not be practicing criminal defense. He buffaloed him into pleading guilty to a felony. He didn't find out, he didn't really understand that he was convicted of a felony until he went to the clerk of court's office and they told him, yeah, you have to do this, this, and this. He immediately called me up. We filed a post-conviction motion. The trial judge, to his credit, reversed the conviction after I explained, you know, how this kid was basically buffaloed into a plea. We took the case to trial. He was acquitted both counts. This entire discussion today, while we were all calmly debating, slicing and dicing this issue, all across the state, that exact scenario has played out in courtrooms hundreds and hundreds of times in Milwaukee, in Green Bay, in Madison, in La Crosse, in Eau Claire. There's lawyers walking into the courtroom. They have no idea who their clients are. They're yelling out names to a sea of people. They're going back in the bullpen trying to find out which one of the guys in the orange jumpsuit is theirs. They have a little quickie 5-minute conversation with them, and that's the extent of their representation. They aren't listening to their clients. They aren't doing investigations. They aren't hiring experts. They aren't doing legal research. Maybe they file a boilerplate motion. When we use terms, loaded terms, like effective assistance of counsel and competent representation and all of these buzzwords that we use when we file briefs in front of this court and maybe the Court of Appeals, what do those really mean? That's the sort of, I guess, really street level we have to look at this at. And that's what I think is missing from this discussion. This isn't about lawyers' greed. And the people on that list are not like Mr. Gleason. Most of them. They aren't that competent and that dedicated. I stopped taking these cases years ago because, quite frankly, I just couldn't afford it. I take maybe one homicide a year or maybe a special case that has sexual assault or, you know, DNA issues that they can't find anybody else for. But other than that, I can't afford it. I have an office in downtown Milwaukee, and my overhead is extremely high. But I do that by choice. And I can afford not to take these cases. A lot of people can't. And that's why the people that are attracted to these appointments are not going to be the top-of-the-shelf lawyers.
You know, Counselor, when Dean Strang testified earlier today, I was very impressed with the way he put together raising the effective level of the defense of indigent criminal defendants in federal court, in that he asked people to sign up again, and then he cut the list way down. Well, raising the dollar amount, or our opining that $40 an hour is too low, isn't going to be a mandate to the legislature. But even if it were, I don't think it solves the problem you're talking about. When I sat on the Court of Appeals, there were two lawyers during the time I sat there that we wrote to the State Public Defender's Office about and asked them never to reappoint them for criminal cases because they did such a poor job at the appellate level. Now, what they were as trial lawyers, I don't know. But from anecdotal information from other judges, I have heard other trial judges say they've done the same thing. So we have a significant problem, I think, on a couple of fronts in regard to the type of representation that indigent folks are receiving in our courts.
Well, that sort of segues into the politics of this. Mm-hmm. Because as several have pointed out, excuse me, you know, simply voting in favor of this petition isn't going to automatically raise the rate that the SPD pays, because it can't. Okay? But as Dean did in that case, he had the luxury of already having in place the Criminal Justice Act with its, you know, increased payments. Mm-hmm. So he was able to very effectively send out the message, because I remember when he did this, because I reapplied, and I still take those cases. And I'm more comfortable taking those because I know that it's at least a somewhat commensurate rate with the kind of work you're doing.
Well, you can at least cover your overhead with what you're getting.
Yeah.
So you're not going in the hole, although some of your services certainly are at a pro bono level still when you take that.
Yeah, rate. Well, you know, and plus there's other problems with the federal in terms of, you know, length of time it takes to get payments. But in coming to grip with the politics, as Justice Prosser had earlier alluded, and I think your question kind of cuts to, is that this court is in a unique position, I think. In fact, really the exclusive position to opine on this subject to the legislature via this petition. This sending of a very strong message to say, no, legislature, this is not okay. This is not okay because not only is it unreasonable, the rate itself. But we, the court, have an obligation to ensure that this quality of work for criminal defendants is not continued, because that's the state of affairs right now.
Well, then we're stepping into the executive branch, aren't we? I mean, you're asking us by the petition to send a strong message to the legislature, but now what you're talking about is sending an equally strong message to the executive branch in regard to what their input may be to the public defenders.
Well, no, you're sending a message to anybody that will listen about what your opinion is about the quality of representation. And by quality, I'm not talking about, you know, a Strickland sort of thing, okay? I'm talking about the duties of counsel, both ethical duties and their duties under the ABA model rules, to provide competent, diligent representation, to communicate with their clients. I can't tell you how many phone calls I get every single week. You know, my lawyer won't call me back. Will you talk to me? I can't get a hold of my lawyer. And the family calls. And if the guy's in jail, the family calls. And, you know, they call them public pretenders or public offenders. And you know, it's ridiculous that it would get to this level. And yet nobody's talking about these people. That's their plight. And I hope this court can, you know, sort of incorporate that into the discussion. And so what we have here is a situation where the legislature doesn't know that. They aren't in a position to evaluate that level of competency. This court is. And they have refused to act. The last time they acted, and just to talk about the raw politics of this, the last time they acted was in 1995. And I believe Justice Prosser referred to coming to grips with the hard politics.
Is that when they dropped the hourly rate?
When they dropped it, and that's my point, is that that was a time when our economy was roaring, when we were flush with cash, we had a balanced budget. And so if there was ever a good time, that would have been the time to raise the rate. But instead we got a cut, and they instituted assigned counsel contracting in certain parts of the state, which has only expanded. So they've made it very clear they refuse to act. And the SPD can put it in their budget all they want, but they're powerless to act. So the only way that the legislature is ever going to do anything on this is if they have some notion that this is not acceptable, that this level of incompetence is not acceptable, and it's tied directly to that rate. And we all know it is, even though, as Dean pointed out earlier, it's not something we can quantify. And I wish I could.
Well,
I want to make these comments so that it was sort of on the record about what the report from the trenches is. And I think that not approving this petition will send an equally strong message, and a negative one, to this effort.
Well, how do you read sub 3? What does sub 3 mean to you?
Sub 3 says to me that we, this court, having reviewed the quality of justice being administered to indigent criminal defendants in the state, find that it's not up to par.
I'm sorry, it's not what?
It's not up to par. It doesn't comport with an attorney's ethical obligations. This is my take on it. How other people are going to interpret it, I don't know. But that, and we find that rate and performance are tied. And it's not acceptable. Even though we're not going to command the legislature to do something about it.
Well, assuming that take is correct, what would be done under this proposal to weed out, in your words, the incompetent, along the lines of what Mr. Strang told us he did at the federal level?
I think exactly what Mr. Strang did is probably something the SPD should look at, because there's a lot of people. I think there's, I believe, about 1,200 people on that list, on the SPD assigned counsel appointment list. Less than half of that number regularly take cases, and about a quarter of that number are the primary people taking those. So let's look at who they are, and I don't have a breakdown from the SPD right now to tell you this, but I can tell you that what I see, and most of those are either people that are eking out a living, sort of doing a mass quantity, and no matter how long they've been practicing, or they're very young, inexperienced, 1-2 years out of law school, that somehow are, you know, very quickly elevated to handling felonies, which they have no business doing.
Well, now, the public defender's office, I can't tell you precisely when, started a system whereby there are educational programs, there are limitations of who they will appoint for a misdemeanor, who they will appoint for a felony, and these are all in the rules, at least they're published in some format. And about half of the cases that, in which we get petitions for review in this court, approximately, are criminal cases. We don't take half of this court's 70 to 65 to 80 cases that we take. Not half of them are criminal cases. So just maybe a 25 to 30, 35% are criminal cases. Ineffective assistance of counsel in the constitutional sense is a frequent issue. But errors, harmless or prejudicial, occur or are complained about all the time, right?
Absolutely.
Even from competent counsel, because we all make mistakes.
Yes.
Right? I mean, I would hate to hear from you, but maybe it's true, that you really have low regard for the work of the public defender's office. Is it only private counsel, or is it their staff, too?
Well,
I've overstated what you want to tell us today.
Well, first of all, this is not something that gives me pleasure to say
I see other lawyers
not performing competently. And I really can't opine on, you know, whether, you know, maybe the line public defenders are, you know, sort of at the same level as the quality I'm talking about. Because even on the assigned counsel list, there's a lot of very, very fine lawyers, but they just aren't going to take up the bulk of the cases because they usually have pretty substantial practices on their own. And people like Mr. Gleason are an exception. He's competent and seems to take on a heavy load. So, I can't say whether or not the staff public defenders and the assigned counsel are sort of on the same plane. I think that
appellate counsel from the state public defenders here all the time do a fine job.
I would agree with that completely.
It's a fine job.
The appellate division is first rate. Absolutely. But I think that if I can leave you with this point, that if somebody is going to tell the legislature that this rate, which is tied to quality, continues, we are not meeting our obligation constitutionally mandated under the Sixth Amendment and Gideon. And if this court isn't the one, this court is uniquely positioned to make that statement. And if you don't do it, then I don't know who's going to do it. Because Wachtel and me or somebody else in the state bar or whatever, we can talk till we're blue in the face. And they could care less, the legislature. But they'll listen to you. And that's what I ask you to do today.
Any questions? Thank you very much, counsel. I'm sorry.
The current rates have been in place 15 years?
The current rate, yes.
Why haven't you come to the court before?
Why hasn't Wachtel come to the court before this court? I cannot answer that question other than to say that it seemed we were trying to play out our as hard as we could in front of the legislature. But year after year after year, just completely disregarded. I think there was one biennium in the late 90s that there was a huge push put on by the state public defenders to try and make this happen. But even that was pushed back. And that was in good times. So, frankly, when you get beaten back that many times, then we finally got the message, okay, I guess the legislature's not going to do anything. And as far as, the current environment, that could very well be the case again.
As you may know, I was there in 1995.
I do.
I can assure you those were not especially good times, but budget was very, very difficult. But I thought your testimony was eloquent and very moving.
Thank you.
Thank you for your testimony and your written statement, Mr. Birdsall, which gave very good facts. Mr. Schultz, you are president of the Wisconsin Association of Criminal Defense Lawyers.
I am. Good afternoon. I come here as the president of the Wisconsin Association of Criminal Defense Lawyers. I'm also a staff attorney with the Public Defender's Office in Rhinelander. I began my contact with this issue in the late 1970s as a law clerk for a couple of county court judges, right before the changes that created the Court of Appeals and the State Public Defender Program. Back in those days, one of the things that I was charged with doing was assisting the judges in finding competent lawyers to take cases at the court appointments at the rate that was then paid by the counties. And I've been struggling as I sit here to remember exactly what that was, because I'm sure that's going to be a question. I'm not sure what it was back in those days. But I was around watching the public defender system come into being. And then shortly after that, I graduated, took cases in private practice for several years in the northern part of the state, up in the Wausau area. Ended up in the Fox Valley and Green Bay and Appleton for many years with the public defender program, both as a staff attorney and later as the first assistant state public defender in Green Bay for 19 years. And in that role, I was asked to some extent monitor not only staff attorneys, but private bar attorneys. And on occasion, with the assistance of our administrative unit, we would have to take action to limit the cases that a private bar attorney could take, or to sometimes, sadly, remove them from the list. Often it would be difficult to do anything because we knew that there were problems, but we didn't have the ammunition we needed, so to speak, to take action. And when it did come, it would often come from a judge or a prosecutor, someone who was in the courtroom when we weren't there to see the problems. And then I'd get a transcript, and we'd look at it, and we'd do something. And now I'm back as a staff attorney living in the northern part of the state. I work with a lot of different attorneys. I see what happens in the courtrooms. And I think I've probably at one time or another been in a third to almost half of the counties of the state practicing criminal law. So I have a perspective that is informed by about, 30 years of doing this kind of work. And what I see are two large groups within the private bar that take our cases. One is a smaller a group of lawyers, but it's a significant number. I would guess it's about a third of the list who are not, frankly, good enough and aren't going to be good enough. And that's why they take the cases. There is a much better group of lawyers, I think slightly larger within that universe, that do take the cases. I think you've heard this to some extent already, but not very many. And Justice Gableman to address your point, if the rate were to be increased to $70 or $80 an hour.
Just to be clear, counsel, I made no point. I asked a question based on the previous speaker's comments.
I would apologize, Justice. Right. I would take your comment to heart and simply I want to address what you said in terms of whether or not it would change anything, the reality.
I asked a question based on the previous speaker, sir.
Thank you. If we had a higher rate, then that smaller group of lawyers, or that group of lawyers that is not taking very, very many cases, would take more of them. I can tell you that from experience. Even if nothing else changed, we would see an automatic increase in the quality. Even if we didn't do what Dean Strang did, which is to reduce the overall pool, you'd see improvement. Am I suggesting that that's all that needs to be done? No. Am I suggesting that the SPD would not take action on their own to potentially be more careful about who gets assigned if the rate's higher or try to pass administrative rules? No, I'm not suggesting that.
Counsel, I think for sure that would happen. I mean, I remember a lot of times lawyers wouldn't take public defender appointments, but they would take court appointments because it was a higher rate. So to me, that's almost a no-brainer. If you had a higher rate, you'd have more lawyers on your list, I think.
So I agree with you. My problem comes up that sub 3 says and sub 1M say that this increase from 70 to 80 does not cover assignments from the state public defender. It only covers court assignments. So we could make it $200 an hour. It would not affect the state public defender appointment schedule. I mean, that's what they say. That's what the proponents say. Because they say if it forces the public defender's office to pay more, you have a direct conflict with the statute and the regs. And they say they're not putting the court into that position. What they want is a precatory statement by the court that concerns, as Mr. Birdsall said, that rate has something to do with quality, aiming it as a humane, let alone constitutional matter, we have to provide quality services to indigent criminal defendants, that's the kind of statement they want. And they do not expect it to change the rate for public defender appointees. I mean, that's what they keep telling us. And you agree?
Yes.
Okay.
So how do
you get from a precatory statement to everything coming out rosy?
Well, I think it's what this court can do at this point. And we've had no action in this regard really forever. And it's what this court can do. And it's not that dissimilar from what this court does in other areas. And one, as I'm sitting here, I grabbed the statute book because I had a recent issue crop up, very different criminal justice issue, but it's in a situation where the court is involved in issuing what apparently are interpreted as advisory court rules or court orders. And that would be Section 885.54. Which has to do with video court hearings. And if you take a look at that statute, it talks about all sorts of things that are supposed, that shall be present. And that includes the right to privately communicate with your client from a remote location during video court. Now, that's just one example, but it's right in there. That doesn't happen. I practice in any number of counties where it doesn't happen. The courts view that as advisory. Now, the fact that that isn't necessarily being followed doesn't mean that I think 885.54 should be changed. Indeed, the opposite. The fact that it exists, and it's been on the books now for about a year and a half, is helpful to arguing to the judges, this is what should happen. This is what should happen.
And if it doesn't, you can get a federal court reversing as due process, which happened, if you're familiar with that case.
Well, actually, I ended up defending the fellow, if you're talking about the Seventh Circuit decision, that
yes, I
ended up with his case in Shawano County recently.
Exactly the one.
And I won't bore you with all the details, but I'm very familiar with that situation. Ultimately, it went back to the U.S. Supreme Court.
Right. I remember.
Yeah.
But there, that went through the rulemaking. That was a pleading practice and procedure rule. So shall came in. Due process was considered. You know, that a trial judge does or doesn't follow the rule is very troublesome, but it's raised in the trial court and comes back up here, maybe, or goes to the Court of Appeals. Estimates are that it takes 10 years to educate everybody when a new statute or new rule is passed. Because education isn't one shot, but every year, twice a year, et cetera. So, you know, that may not be it. But you don't read this rule as requiring the judge to do anything, number three.
No, I would agree with everything you've said and everything that I've heard here as to this being the court's statement as to what indeed is a reasonable rule, and I agree that that is a function of this a function of this court.
I'm very flattered that you all think this court has such great power. And for public purposes, I'm going to agree with you, but I would like to make a confession. The court has, on a number of occasions, gone to the legislature. It's gone to joint finance with written statements. Has gone to the fiscal bureaus with budget statements, supporting more funding for prosecutors and defenders, has supported more recently compensation increases so that you can obtain and retain good counsel. And I must say, we've had the same success as you all have thus far. So I join you in saying that the court should stand firmly and fastly. I personally join. That the court should stand firmly and fastly for qualified counsel in criminal defense, and that they should be paid well, considering the fiscal issues in the state and considering that state, you know, you're sure you're going to get paid most of the time, et cetera. And you understand what that's my shorthand. I join you on all of that. My problem is the language here is to my mind, too ambiguous. And I've suggested a whereas clause. I don't think that's really good. I discarded that because it doesn't come into play in the statute books. A comment does ride with the statute, with the rule. And this is an SCR. That's good. A third way of doing it that I've thought about is a policy kind of statement prefacing this SCR, and that would always ride with this and make a strong statement. But I wanted a strong statement and clear, and since we're not confronting legislative enactments or the regulations, I don't want it to be misunderstood.
I can certainly understand that point of view. I did want to add one thing in that vein, if I might. Our organization is a little short of 500 lawyers. They're all over the state, mostly in smaller
public
firms.
Public defenders, lawyers join you?
No, I'm speaking on behalf of the Wisconsin Association of Criminal Defense Lawyers. I'm not speaking on
behalf
of the
No, I understand that, but I wanted to know where the staff of the public defenders office are members of your organization.
Yes, yes.
As individuals.
Yes, I would guess that about, and it's, I don't have the figures in front of me, but roughly 20% are probably staff attorneys, about 80% private attorneys. Mm-hmm. I would say that the majority of the attorneys in our organization do not take SPD cases. There's a sizable minority that do. I've talked with many of them over many years. I'm a charter member of the organization. And we talk about things like what are they paying in this county for a dean appointment versus that county? How are different judges handling it? And I can tell you that the existing 8102 is not viewed in many of the counties of this state as a mandatory rate. It is viewed the way it's being handled in Milwaukee County, which is that judges have the ability to adjust it according to the severity of the case, the experience of the lawyer, and so forth. And what we're talking about doing here, I think, is amending the dollar amount in that rule. I don't know that it would be that difficult for the existing judges in this state to interpret the rule any differently than they are now. I don't think it places a mandate. It doesn't require funding. It does make a statement, a powerful statement, and one that I urge this court to adopt.
Counsel, I have two questions. Number one, how, if at all, does increasing court-appointed rate from $70 to $80 enhance the quality of the pool of attorneys? And two, how, if at all, by raising the court-appointed rate from $70 to $80, will it affect the quality of public defender appointed attorneys?
Justice Bradley, are you referring to just criminal cases or the entire pool of cases?
Your question and response explains some of my concern, and that is almost the dissonance today of what we are doing and being asked to do is to increase 70 to 80 in court-appointed, which includes civil and what I referred to before as constitutionally indigent.
Sure. Dean.
And I am not persuaded that raising from 70 to 80 is going to enhance either the quality or quantity. And that's the arguments I'm getting. You know, we need better, and we need more of better. Same thing with, and I'm not persuaded that it's going to affect at all better public defender appointments or more better public defender appointments. So I get a dissonance because the arguments I hear are, we need better public defender representation if we can only increase the rates. But the rate we're being asked to increase, I'm not sure, has a causal effect to the desired goal. So that's my question. How, if at all, 70 to 80 for all court-appointed attorneys, is it going to increase the quality or quantity of attorneys taking it? And how, if at all, is that increase going to affect the quality or quantity of public defender appointments?
With regard to the first question, $10 an hour is going to result in a marginal improvement both in the quantity and the quality. You could probably do a study to measure before and after. I would agree it's probably not going to have the kind of significant impact that we all would like, but it is going to create a marginal difference.
May I just interject? See, that argument resonates to me or the idea of 70 to 80. Look, it's been since the early 1990s, 70. This is 15, 16, 17 years later, $10 more. Makes sense to me. You know, cost of living goes up. But that's not the argument we get so much as it is it's going to increase the quality of attorneys.
Well, what I think most of us here are focused on is the reasonableness clause and taking that statement and doing a lot more work to get a legislative solution that is way long overdue and is one that we have been unable to get any other way.
Yes.
And to answer the question, why, Justice Prosser, why didn't we do this earlier? Why didn't the Wisconsin Association of Criminal Defense Lawyers do something earlier? We should have. You know, we make mistakes. We should have done more. And here we are saying to you, the time has come. It's never going to be an easy issue. It's never going to be easy at this level, at the legislative level, at the executive level. But I believe the time has come. It's way overdue.
See, what I hear you all saying today, and maybe I'm wrong, but Justice Bradley sort of hit on this. It's not the $10 difference that you're really focused in on here, and you're not saying that that's going to make the lists bigger or better. But you're looking for an overall message to be sent that, gee, $40 for the state public defender is not a reasonable amount. Legislature, even the court says $80. You know, you should listen. It's one more tool, if you will, to use as you proceed and try to get the legislature to take a look at the public defender rates. Even though, realistically, you know courts around the state and different counties function differently. They set different rates for criminal cases. They set different rates for GAL cases. They do reimbursements or collections differently. Every county is kind of different, and you're leaving that clause in here that says that counties can contract differently. So the common theme, it seems, is you're just looking for the court to send a message that 80 is closer to the mark than 40, it seems, even though you know as a practical matter that's not going to have a big effect in each of the counties. Am I wrong?
No, I don't think so. But I also think it sends a secondary message, which is that the rate, even at 70, is at a level that is unacceptable and needs to go the other direction. It sends a message to some of the judges who are currently appointing dean appointments at under $70 an hour that, you know, you've got to come up a little bit.
In all fairness, though, to those judges, in our county, we were at $40 an hour. And when I went to the county board and talked to them about raising it to, I think, 60, the big pushback was, well, why? You have plenty of lawyers who will take it at 40. And that's a tough one to answer. So then you have to be able to explain, well, here's how we're going to do it, and we're going to try some collection efforts and some different things, and you're really not going to see a big impact, but we'll have a bigger list, a better list of lawyers. And it's true, all those things happened, at least in where I was. But the county board, in the end, no matter how you slice it, is going to have X amount in their budget. And so if they're giving it to lawyers or court appointments and you don't have increased collections, it's going to come from somewhere. And so they're going to do something. They're going to cut court commissioners, or they're going to find it somewhere. It's what Mr. Barrett said earlier. I mean, they're not going to give you more money. And so you got to figure out how you're going to make this increase work on the same amount of money. That's the practical effect of this. And so as people go to their county boards, that's the real nut they have to crack. They have to figure out how to tell these people, we can increase it, but it's really not going to cost you anymore.
Well,
that's the tough one.
I don't pretend to say that it's just the way you put it, that we can increase it, but it's not going to cost you anymore. But I think what will happen within this state is perhaps what has happened around this country since Gideon, and we talked about this earlier, which is that each county can try some, you know, creative solutions, understanding that it's a critical issue for justice. It is important that we have better lawyering on the defense side than we have.
But different counties do have different needs. I mean, what's happening in Columbia County, that's tough. I mean, what's happening to their court system is really, really difficult for the judges and for the administration of justice. And that's a really tough place. And you compare that across the state, and it varies from county to county, and the relationships with county boards varies, and what people are willing, and the lawyers willing to take cases, it varies. So to a great degree, it seems to me, while you can send a message, in the end, that 1M has to mean something, and that has to mean they still can do what they need to do to make things work and get decent lawyers on lists in various counties.
And if I suggested that wasn't the case, I didn't mean to.
I don't think you did.
Yeah,
I'm just saying it comes from somewhere, though. I mean, Mr. Barrett was absolutely right. It's not going to – it's going to affect other things.
Understood. Any other questions?
Well, as I keep saying, I'm trying to think of different ways of attacking this, of a comment, of a public policy beginning. This court, a while back, each justice signed a letter saying to the legislature that there were issues about financing elections, and the court thought that public financing of elections for Supreme Court justices
meaningful public finance.
Right. Each member of a previous court, this member has not signed such a letter.
I'm trying to look for techniques because you obviously want the court on record with the legislature, right? And with judges.
In a perfect world, yes. I mean,
And so I'm trying to think of that. Is a letter or some other document a correct way to go? Anyway, think about that.
Thank you. Thank you for that suggestion.
And maybe your answer should be, do it all. Put it in a comment, put it in the public policy beginning, send a letter, put it in your budget papers, put it in your joint finance papers, because you have to do it cumulatively. People don't hear something, if you can tell them 30 times, it doesn't sink in unless it fits with something that they have any experience with. And you have to do it over and over again because the court changes, the legislature changes, the executive changes, so it's constant and continual. So maybe that's what something should be done, namely ask the court to do it all the time in every message. Put it in the state of the judiciary message. I mean, these are all things that we've done, but that we have to keep doing it over and over and over again.
On behalf of our organization, I want to thank you.
Right.
And other members of the court for your time and your efforts. And in closing, please do it all.
Thank you, Mr. Schultz. Thank you. Deb Smith of the State Public Defender's Office. Ms. Smith.
Thank you. May it please the court, Chief Justice, members of the court, good afternoon. My name is Deborah Smith, and I'm here on behalf of the Wisconsin State Public Defender. I'm going to forego my prepared remarks.
You submitted a document, too.
We Go did ahead. Submit some written remarks,
you still
yes.
stand on that?
Yes.
Okay.
I am currently the director of the Assigned Counsel Division. This is the division that is responsible for the private bar part of the Public Defender program. It's my division that pays bills at $40 an hour, except because of the chronic underfunding every other year, we don't even pay the $40 an hour for months at a time. I would like to address some of the points and questions the court has asked other speakers, and then I am just here for you if you have questions of me for the public defender. As other people have indicated, the state public defender started out as an appellate branch within the judicial branch of government. In 1977, the legislature created Chapter 977, and we had a statewide trial office that was implemented beginning in 1978.
What happened between 66 and 1977 when Bob Friedman was the public defender?
I wasn't anything but a junior high school student then, so I wasn't paying attention.
I'll check it out, because according to the statutes, your office as it now is established was created in 1977.
Yes, it's my understanding that it was, as Mr. Friedman said, that it was originally created as just an appellate office within the judicial branch,
right.
And it remained that until 1977.
And it was countywide, and I busily checked Chapter 29, and I'll tell you, I haven't found it yet, but that's irrelevant. It's okay.
What are you looking for?
Okay. When the state public defender was, as we now know it, more or less, was created in 1977 and implemented, it was implemented as an independent state agency, so it's not exactly true that we're an executive branch agency. We're an independent state agency, although we submit our budget and some other things through the executive branch.
So does the court.
Yes. Currently, we have some questions about how many cases staff handle versus how many cases go to the private bar. At this point in time, we're about 60-40 staff private bar. 80,000 to staff, 50,000, give or take, to the private bar. As other people have mentioned, we have finally gotten some updates to our eligibility guidelines. It was passed in the last legislative session. But again, as other people have pointed out, implementation of those changes depends on the budgets that were just submitted to fund those positions and those cases. I would also like to address some comments made by the Chief Justice about her electrician and furnace repair guy at $80 per hour, to point out that, to the best of my knowledge, lawyers taking public defender cases are the only vendors in state government whose rate is fixed by statute, rather than part of a bid process that would in some way reflect a market rate. I am glad that Mr. Birdsall indicated his concern for clients, because in the end, the right to counsel is a personal right. In the end, it is about the client, and the Wisconsin State Public Defender wants to do what's right for its clients. If you have questions, I'd be happy to answer them. You know, I've been with the public defender 30 years and been dealing with this budget stuff for 10 years, so I'm here for you.
Bill, how do you read subsection 3? And what, in an ideal world, would you like the court to do?
Well, I think...
I know you did not take a position on this particular
right.
bill. Petition.
What I would like to do is first thank this court for the support it's shown for the public defender program and justice system funding in general over the years. We're aware of the work the court has done, and it has, although in some ways we haven't made a great deal of progress, it has been helpful to have the court's support for justice funding and for the public defender in particular.
Now, we have even appeared before legislative committee, which we don't usually do at
yes.
your request. I mean, I can't remember what the committee was, but John Velker and I were there.
Yes, and we were very glad of it. So with respect to sub 3, we're not taking position on this petition. You could read it one way to say that what we're doing is unreasonable. If it's unreasonable, then we should be paying more than $40 an hour. If we pay more than $40 an hour, the practical effect would be that we would simply run out of money sooner. The other way you could read it is that the statute is the statute, and we continue to pay $40 an hour and nothing changes, and we still run out of money, just not quite as soon.
If the rate is at an hourly rate and you run out of money because you're not reimbursed by the state as an hourly rate, but at an estimate of what the hourly the number of hours times the hourly rate? Do you get a lump sum? Is that what you get?
Yes, we get a lump sum. And the
what's that based on? I mean, if it's really not based on the hourly rate, then?
No.
Okay.
The history of that is that at some time in the late 80s, the legislature made a decision. It was a tight budget time. People were looking for money. At that point, because we were doing everything by paper like everybody else, it took several months for us to process bills and pay. And so the legislature in one session basically short-funded us. So we were only funded for our estimated expenses for 21 months instead of 24 months, which created what we call a drought, a three-month drought. And over the biennia, that drought has rolled over from time to time. But at some point in the 90s, going into the 2000s, as we did not get additional staff positions and the number of cases coming in the door continued to increase, more and more cases went to the private bar, and that drought began to grow. So that at this point, according to the most recent quarterly report that we submitted to the Department of Administration, is for this biennium, which will end June of next year, we're looking at a shortfall for private bar payments of $9.2 to $9.5 million, which in The bottom line is we're going to run out of money about the second week in February.
Well, what are you actually paid per hour for the lawyers that you appoint? Did you ever figure that out, given what they actually pay you and the number of hours you get submitted?
We pay $40 an hour. They may have to wait for 3, 4, or 5 months. But
Justice Robinsack, okay. I think, is asking you, if you take the appropriation to your department.
Yes.
And you take the amount you pay to private counsel, you pay at the rate of $40. But in effect, if you look at the appropriation and you divided that by the number of lawyers in their hours, it would come out to less than 40 because you do not get $40 times the amount of number of hours that you are billed. Do you understand?
Okay, so if I took the number of hours worked by all the private bar and a certain date parameter,
right.
You know, what am I really paying out?
You're really paying out 40, we hope, but you're getting 25. That's right. Why there's a shortfall.
But see, that's what I'm trying to figure out. What's the legislature really paying you? Are they really paying you $40 an hour? Or do they just pay it, but they pay it next year, so they pay it late?
Right. They really pay it, but they just pay it late.
Okay, so that's what I was wondering.
So July 1st, we press the button, and all of the backlogged payments for the last 5 months get shipped off to DOA, and they cut the checks.
Okay, gotcha.
So basically, the private bar is financing the public defender system for however many months we don't have money to pay.
But there's going to be a coming time where you're going to have to press the button, and it'll be a whole year.
Well, you know, if we don't add staff and cases continue to increase, that would be the result. Now, you know, there has been we have staffed up based on some budgetary changes, the budget before last. There have been some decriminalization and some overall reductions in filings that have, you know, reversed the steep trend upwards, but you know, that could be the result.
And you've gone in and asked for more?
We have
than $40?
Yes. Our budget is submitted by the Public Defender Board. That's our independent agency layer between us and any of the other branches of government. So it's the Public Defender Board that submits the budget. And each budget since 1995, when the rate was reduced, we have submitted a budget requesting an increase in the private bar rate. And we've had various arguments and variations and alternatives to that each and every time. And it's part of the budget that was just submitted in September as well. And we've advocated it vigorously with the legislature during legislative sessions as well.
I understand you to say that when we get to mid-February, you will not be able to pay bills for the next 4.5 months?
That's correct.
On July 1st, is the money automatically there if there isn't a budget?
Historically, yes. I suppose that a legislature could, between February and July, say, you know, we're doing away with the public defender, but other than that, July 1st, we have money in the bank again. We press the button and people get paid.
Okay. Could you describe what exactly did Act 164 do?
The eligibility bill? The eligibility bill updated our financial eligibility guidelines from we had been dependent on 1988 AFDC tables all this time. It basically updated financial eligibility to be in line with, basically, with W-2. So roughly 100-125% of federal poverty level. That would go into effect, I think, June 19th. We've been allocated a number of staff positions for that, so that of those additional 12,000 or so cases that would now come into the public defender's office, about 75% would be handled by staff and 25% would go out to the private bar.
that those eligibility standards will take effect June 19th?
I believe that's the start date.
Of this year or last
year? Of 2011.
2011. And you're supposed to get something like 45 new staff people?
There are a number of staff attorneys plus support staff associated to handle the 75% of the expected increase in cases.
Are you betting on that?
Betting on?
45 new staff people?
That this legislature will fund those positions?
Not funded, no.
They're not funded. We have position authority for them, but funding for those positions and all the associated costs, both for staff and private bar, are in the budget that was just submitted in September.
Let me ask this question. When we have admissions ceremonies here, I generally come down and talk to the new admittees.
Yes.
And a very large and disturbing number of them are unemployed.
Yes, sir.
I like to ask, well, what are your plans? And many of them say to me, well, I think I'll take some public defender cases. And I always wince a little bit at that, not because I don't think these folks are competent, but they certainly are inexperienced by and large. And then I know that if they take cases, they might not be paid for 4.5 months. And they're paid at $40 an hour, unless they're dean cases. How do you address the quality of, or how do you address the question of quality of the attorneys that you put on your list?
Yes, what we do, we have a mandate to ensure quality of the private bar. And the things that we are able to do in that respect are that we have what we call certification criteria, so that if you want to sign up for a misdemeanor, you have to have this. And if you want first-level felonies, there are additional experience and litigation experience requirements and so on up the ladder. Certain training for juvenile cases or mental health commitments or TPRs. And we just recently completed a rewrite of all of those certification rules to accurately reflect the change in felony certification and the complexity of some juvenile cases over the past years, beefed up the criteria. We now provide for the first year is provisional certification, so that if somebody isn't working out, we can address that early on. We also have a CLE requirement that we enforce, 6 credits of public defender-related CLE each year. If they're not completed and reported, we suspend people from the list. We have all kinds of low-cost and no-cost training for the private bar. We have online resources. We have minimum attorney performance standards, which are published. We have minimum expectations about client communication and direction about that. On our website, we have a most excellent case summary blog, which I'm sure some of you have seen. So we provide that kind of support to try and improve the quality of practice generally. We also take action to remove people from the list. And when we do have the cooperation of the judiciary or prosecutors or other lawyers that bring specific conduct to my attention, I do investigate it and I do remove people. And since I became the director in 2003, I've removed close to 60 lawyers from the list for performance problems and issued 100 or more additional cautions. And actually, the certification rewrite that we just did, in addition to beefing up the certification criteria, we also expanded the the range of options that we have to address performance issues. In the past, it was either you're on the list or you're off the list. So I have a greater flexibility to address performance issues. So if there is a training issue, I can address it with training. If it's not a training issue, I can address it otherwise. So those are the sorts of things that we are able to do. Our system is different from the federal system. The way that 977 was written basically provides an entitlement to lawyers in Wisconsin to be on the public defender list. I have between 1,100 and 1,300 lawyers on the list, depending on the year and the time of year. And it's just me. You know, in terms of, you know, you look at the ABA 10 principles, and principle number 10 is systematic supervision and monitoring. And it's me and 1,300 lawyers. And, you know, I think I'm pretty talented, but, you know, that's kind of a stretch even for me. This isn't the federal system, and I was most envious when I listened to Dean Strang talk about how he set up his private bar panel, because that makes a lot of sense, and that goes a long way to ensure quality, but that's not what I have to work with.
Oh, and you didn't start at the beginning either. You started in the middle, which I think makes a big difference, too.
Yes. Starting in the middle is not always the best place to get to start.
A lot harder.
Thank you. Thank you.
What can we do to help you? Since that's the big point of this proceeding.
I think that, you know, we would like to be able to rely on this court for the kind of support that you've expressed in the past. We're committed to a legislative solution to this issue, and to the extent that you can support us in that, we desperately need your support and welcome it, and I'm happy to meet with you and talk with you about that at any time. So I think that's what you can do for us.
Any other questions or comments? Ms. Smith, thank you for appearing, and I want to thank you on behalf of the court for the many things you have done for the court. You sat on committees and still sit on committees and have been very active, and we appreciate that.
Thank you.
Is there anyone else who wishes to appear on 10-03? Seeing, hearing no one, Mr. Skelton, you have the wind-up.
Thank you, and I know I have some risk of overstaying my welcome. But first, on behalf of the petitioners, I thank the court for this entire day. It was a discussion that was made with candor and good faith, and the issues that have been raised by the justices and I think by the lawyers are all on the money, are all appropriately a part of the deliberation of the court. It's a conversation that has to happen and is long overdue, and this court has to be involved as the petition requests. And now I have a confession to make. I liked the ambiguity of three.
I bet.
But the court has, concessions have been made by co-counsel such that I concede the court's concern about its ambiguity and suggest that there may be matters by way of drafting that takes away the question of confrontation and dispute with the legislature, but still gets you where we would like to see you go. And I haven't thought it through, but one way is the presumption route. Instead of a mandate, you'd draft it with the word presumption in there. The court had other language of similar import that would make this more in the nature of prescriptive as distinct from mandatory. May I also suggest that this court on occasion has dealt with rules decisions by issuing opinions. The one that I think has been most useful to me in my activities in the integrated bar is the thorough decision-making and opinions of the court with reference to the integrated bar petition. The court may recall that as recently as last year, the old presidents submitted the opinion of Justice Babbage in a very crucial context with respect to that issue. And I use that only by way of example to say to the court that the petitioners are serious in their invitation to the court to speak on this issue. And I would suggest, maybe somewhat presumptuously, that by not speaking, you're speaking. The fact that nothing has been said for 15 years, when plain facts are in front of the court, is a form of speaking. And I believe the time has come to speak. I'm pleased to say that I'm not an accountant nor an actuary, and I'm certainly not a justice, and so it's easy for me to say today. But there are several things that I think are worth at least saying before we, the petitioners, conclude our presentation. And I know the court is grappling with the costs, all costs inherent in the justice system. I have had the opportunity recently to read some of the current works. And as I read one of the most recent works, it was the study of the cost of the entire justice system, including the system of incarceration in the state of Wisconsin. And I think the budget there, and I will certainly be corrected because I do not wish to be inaccurate, is in the neighborhood of $1.2 billion, 7% of the entire budget. And if you look at this question of costs in reference to the system as a whole somewhat differently than at the level of payment, but in the sense of cost to the system as a whole of the potential of inadequate representation, then maybe, just maybe, you'll look at those costs differently and in perspective. They are real, they are substantial, but they are marginal in the context of the system of justice in the state of Wisconsin. The other thing that I think is easily said and not overlooked by the court, but I think ought to be said again, is that the particular constituency that we're advocating for here is not the lawyers per se who seek the 70 to 80 if they do at all. And Justice Bradley, your point is well taken that, you know, 70 to 80 really isn't solving the problem. Maybe it's more symbolic than in a sense of a real cure. But the problem really is that the legislature doesn't relate well to this constituency, and who are they? They are the persons who are being subject to prosecution and have no money. That is a very politically weak constituency, and legislatures aren't likely to look at that when setting priorities for the budgetary expenses, but somebody has to. That is the Gideon prescription. And when you talk about it, you can say it's an unfunded mandate that we're requesting, that those terrible two words. And I guess, yes, it is, but my response is that in this country there have been at least two unfunded mandates that were far more expensive than what we're talking about, and the first, in my opinion, is Brown versus Board of Education. I don't think that any accountant can fully account for the cost of implementation of the elimination of segregation, but I believe it was worth the price
Right. It was worth that price, counsel, because it was demonstrated that the quality of education was going to go up for the students denied equal access. Here, it seems to me, the thrust of a lot of questioning, including some of my own, which was candidly responded to by a couple of the people who responded, by both of them who responded to it, is how is the quality of representation going to go up for the constituency you discuss and for which we all have empathy? Counsel, I don't think you need to presume anything other than all seven members of this court have great empathy for the constituency of which you speak. However, the real question is, how does that advance the cause of their getting enhanced representation?
Justice Gableman, the question is, as I understand it, at least partially addressed in the attachments that are made to the brief. Unfortunately, most of the evidence that I am aware of is empirical and anecdotal, but not statistical. And these are qualitative judgments made by Slade, for example. This is attachment 8 of the brief that I'm referring to. It's the price of Gideon.
Did any of the responses from any of the previous people indicate, for instance, Mr. Strang talking about going through the list of the federal system and some of the other attorneys here discussing perhaps a potential review? Did any of that kind of resonate with you?
Yes, it did.
How so?
Well, in the sense that I believe that the price here, the cost of the lawyer, the fee we pay, results in, intuitively, at least to me, a higher quality of representation, and that by doing so, more lawyers will be attracted to these cases who are competent and able to perform at the level that these cases require. So it did resonate with me to say that in the process of having more funds to deal with it, he sorted out his list. That's the way I understood it, Justice Gableman. And that, therefore, I found a cause and effect relationship to the price. I 70 to 80, I'm not here to testify to that, nor am I here to preach to the court. I do accept the fact that all seven justices believe as I do in this issue. It's a very tough one to deal with. It's a very small step that we're suggesting, and really what I am suggesting is a statement by the court that is usable in a public sense to get this issue properly articulated. I hear the chief on the legislature not always listening, but I, for one, believe that this court has the loudest voice of any lawyer in the state. And it's something worth stating, in my opinion. And that's what we're asking.
Right, so it's more getting down to the thing. It seems to me what you're saying now in the last minute or two, it's more like a symbolic gesture that you're asking us to make, to say I'm not trying to mischaracterize your statement, but that's what I've
I hear you, and I think that is a characterization that
and symbols are very important. I don't say that to denigrate your comment. I
understand, and I am accepting that, but stating that it is maybe the best we can do. There is no point right now in attempting a pyrrhic confrontational, constitutional confrontation with the legislature. The court doesn't have, as I heard the court's question, you don't have an adequate record in front of you to make that judgment. That's a litigated judgment. And I don't presume to suggest that you should. And therefore, in the context of what we've asked for, then maybe it is the symbolic statement of the court, to use, as I understood it, your phrase. But we are asking for something in the sense of getting the court enlisted in what I think was recognized as a problem. I also didn't hear from the court any suggestion that there was subscription to $40 an hour as being the answer either, even reasonable. At least I didn't hear that.
Right, but what we did hear over and over is the discussion that what we're talking about is the difference between 70 and 80, not 40 and 80.
Well, of course, the 40-80 is the sub 3 issue, but and that's the one I admit to I like the ambiguity on. But it is toward 80, even if it's at 40 at this point, possibly through advocacy, using the court's support, and making progress on this issue. And I, honestly, to borrow on the statement of I think it was Justice Bradley, if I had my way, we'd be in here at 150 an hour. But we're not. We're asking for a start in the process. We're asking for the court to weigh in and be heard so that we at least can use that as best we can. I do not presume on the court in terms of any suggestion. It was unintended, if I made it, that every one of the seven justices agrees on the notion that this is a problem. The question is, what do we do about it? At least that's the way I heard the discussion today.
Counsel, when I hear that what you're interested in is a conversation that has to begin and is long overdue, and when I hear comments addressing, in essence, that this is symbolic, that sounds to me like you're backing away from something that's very concrete, 70 to 80. I don't think you tell me. Do you mean to do that or do you not mean to do that?
I am accepting reality. I heard the court's comments, and I take them seriously. When I said that I liked the ambiguity of three, what I really liked was the clarity. Somewhat ironic statement. Because if you read it, it says that the payment of an hourly rate less than the rate set forth in Supreme Court Rule 8102 for legal services rendered pursuant to appointment by the state public defender under Wisconsin statute section 97708 is unreasonable. I like that clarity. I've been talked out of that issue in the sense of conceding ambiguity. And the ambiguity, as I understand it, is in its administration and effect, as it may relate to other statutes or rules. And so I concede that. I'm not backing away from that statement, Justice Bradley. I believe it to be true. In fact, if you raised it to a higher number, I would also say that would be true in today's world. And it is not the perfect answer, and it isn't the full answer, to say 80 doesn't solve the problem. But I thank the court for its attention and its questions.
Well, I want to continue on my exploration of techniques to be used. And comes January, February, usually in February, the court meets with legislative committees in open session here. Committees treated as a regular committee meeting. And we usually meet with both the Senate and the assemblies. They have different names for that, but it's the criminal justice sessions. And we might, if the chairs agree, because this is a joint meeting, put on the agenda this issue. But I have to get them to agree. That's our ground rules for running these. The other thing, this is in terms of continuing the discussions. The other thing that, for a continuing discussion, is the court has joined up with the Legislative Council so that every 2 years, and I think we're coming up on the year in which we do it, we select a topic, and I say we, but it's really the Legislative Council selects a topic that affects both the legislative and judicial branch and sometimes the executive branch, all three branches. And we have a day seminar, and judges, staff, legislative staff, executive staff join. And 1 year we had as the topic, I'm not going to state it quite right, but an essence of it was eyewitness identification and issues about that in present research, included DNA too. And that
was a very interesting session that people came to and had an effect on legislation and on the Department of Justice on eyewitness identification. So maybe this is a seminar topic that, again, this may be of great interest to the courts and of no interest immediately to the legislature. Then it will not be put on the agenda. It has to be something that there can be agreement on, and ordinarily the legislature has the biggest say because it's run by the Legislative Council. So I'm certainly going to think about that in terms of, again, these communications. Now, you mentioned an opinion. The court will issue an order, and it will have prefatory comments. The court issues an order, and it will have long comments on it. That's my whereases. The court will issue an order, and there will be concurrences and dissents that are of length that explore this particular area. Having heard all that, in having heard at least some comments about concerns about sub 3, what do you think the court should do about sub 3? I know that you petitioned for 3, you like 3, but
I liked it,
at least for me it has problems.
I'm persuaded of two things. First, it is ambiguous in the analysis of the court, and secondly, it can be improved on to eliminate that ambiguity. One suggestion would be a presumption route.
You said presumption, right.
Another would be to tinker with the language, as the court, I think, was suggesting, to rephrase it so it's not mandatory or whatever, and give prescription by rule of reasonableness, but not in a mandatory sense, and not as so as to create legal problems for those administering the payments here, which I heard loud and clear. But I do think, and I do suggest that some comment by the court on these issues that have been fairly fully explored today, not in an evidentiary sense, but in terms of the anecdotal evidence, would be very helpful to this dialogue. And on behalf of the petitioners, it's anticipated that this dialogue will not only be to this court, but to the legislature. And realizing the realistic hurdles that exist today, nevertheless, it's a conversation that has to be had. So whatever forum the court would suggest will be well received by us, and we'll try to create our own as appropriate.
Thank you, Mr. Skilton. Any comments or questions?
Thank you.
Yeah, and Mr. Skilton, on behalf of the court, I want to thank all of the participants, those who were here, those who did not come but who worked with this, that this is the court recognizes a very important issue constitutionally, statutorily, and otherwise, and that we appreciate your long, hard labor in these in this field. And we have a long way to go. And that concludes our hearing in 10-03 in the matter of the petition to amend Supreme Court Rule 81.02. The court will meet in open administrative conference after its next rule hearing, 10-04. All right, 10-04, in the matter of the petition to amend Supreme Court Rule 2116, 2219, and 2229, establishing standards and procedures for permanent revocation. The presenters in the order in which they wish to speak are, according to my list, Rod Rogan, who's Vice Chair, Board of Administrative Oversight, Edward Cannon, Chair, Culinary Review Committee, and Mark Peterson, Chair, Board of Administrative Oversight. everybody has had a chance to stand and move, so if you don't mind, the court will do likewise, so we can just stand up in place. It's running to 3:20, so I don't want to, if I let the court out, it's usually 10 or 15 minutes, if I can hold them here, we might be able to stand at ease for a few moments, if that's okay with you. And people expect to come at particular times, so I'm sorry this might be a shorter hearing, but we do it in numerical order unless I know for sure that it's going to be terribly, terribly short. Anyway, it was an educational session, right?
One.
I don't agree, but try that when we do sit down and it might help.
I've got my one up.
What you looking for, guys?
I have everything that I need. That's what we have.
Mine is okay.
You should see what I got.
Thank you. You may approach the bench. How are you? Good to see you. Thank you very much.
You might come and look. Yeah, you can just find me.
Hi there. How are you doing?
I'd say hi.
How are you doing?
It's been a long time.
Yes, it has indeed.
Good presentation.
Thank you very much.
Thanks for taking the time to come.